You're listening to Auto D coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Network Studios, broadcasting from high above County Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, and this evening, my guest is a man that has made his mark in the Valley of the Sun and has influenced a lot of musicians along the way. Singer-songwriter Bruce Canole will be joining us right after this song from the Fervor Records catalog called Stuck, performed by Noonday Devils here on the Auto D Show. Check it out.
Listening to Auto D coming at you live.
And that was Stuck by Noonday Devils here on the Auto D Show, which is brought to you tonight by Fervor Records. You can check them out online at fervor-records.com. And you can follow me and this show on Instagram and Facebook and all by visiting my website at autod.com. That's OTTOD.com. Or simply download the Auto D app in your app store. For your phone, it has access to this live podcast and nearly 200 previous shows. You can also stream my original music on it and check out my concert schedule. So best of all, it's totally free. So if you're inclined to grab it, feel free and give me your feedback. I'd really appreciate it. And now without further ado, let me welcome to the show this evening's guest, Valley songwriter and singer and producer of the song you just heard, Mr. Bruce Canole. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing okay, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great. That was a nice track.
Yeah, well, they... There's some good little tunesmiths, those boys. They're good.
Now, most, before we talk a little bit about this project that you produced with Stuck, or no, excuse me, with the Noonday Devils,
right?
Let's talk about your role as a producer. Most people think of you as a singer-songwriter, and I know you've produced some of your own recordings. Have you produced other bands often?
Not really. Without going into the whole history of it, this originally started out as a remixing project.
Okay.
Because, you know, they weren't happy with what they had. And it turned into a re-recording project. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't, you know. Well, it was weird because, you know, so Jeff and those guys, they give me the tracks and they're like, oh, okay, the band's not happy with it. Can you fix it? Right. So I'm trying to fix it and I'm referencing like AC/DC and stuff, whatever, you know, because I'm thinking, oh, okay, guitars, drums, whatever. And then I brought the guys over. I thought I had, you know, an okay mix. And I played it for them. And they're like, I don't know. I was like, crestfallen as I was, I said, well, I don't get it. And then they go, well, listen to the demo. And I go, oh, there's a demo. Well, that's good to know. That's helpful information. And the minute I heard the demo, I knew exactly, you know, at least in my mind at any rate, what they wanted or what, I don't know, whatever, the direction that it should move in.
Right.
It was like, we got to retrack everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we couldn't retrack the drums, but we did everything else. And then so I don't know. I don't know if you could call me a producer or whatever, but that's what I did, you know. So
yeah, well, I think that puts you in actually some of the best producers. Who was it who did Chicago 13? Told him, I think you need to rewrite all your songs and start the song.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I didn't have to go that far, but, you know, just, yeah, that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, when you are producing a group, I mean, you've made a lot of records and been playing and writing for a long time. Do you tend to try and find what you think is really cool about them, or is what you feel is wrong just stick out glaringly?
Well, with these guys, I don't know. It's kind of hard to put it in words, you know.
Okay.
It's just, you know, this project was easy because I liked it.
Okay.
You know, I liked the material.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I live a pretty low-key life, so I rarely have to do stuff that I don't want to do.
Right.
And you know, the fact that I liked the material and I could hear what they were doing in the demo, you know, so
it made sense.
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't difficult. It was like, oh, okay, I can see what, you know, so we just need to make this happen.
Right.
You know, that's all we got to do.
So and how many guys are in the group?
There's two. There's two guys.
Cool.
And Freddie and the other guy.
Joey.
The little guy. Yeah, no, I was trying to... Kind of stab him in the back.
Okay.
Joey, the Tom guy. Tom guy.
Yeah, the Tom guy. So do they both write?
No, I think it's mostly Frederick. I mean, I could be wrong, but as far as I know, it's Frederick does most of the songwriting.
Cool. And so this record, when does this come out? Are you sure?
You know, as far as any of that stuff, I have no idea.
I'm pretty sure it's in January sometime, but I wasn't sure if there's a particular.
I know the vinyl's out because Freddie brought it over the house the other night.
Okay.
It's really nice. Translucent red.
Okay. Kind of cool.
Yeah, no, I was like, oh, wow, a record.
You have a turntable still.
I do have a turntable because I have to do a lot of restoration for Fervor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I do all their restoration type stuff, you know, and they get their material from wherever they get it, you know, and it's usually whether it's tape or record, stuff like that.
So you do a lot of the transfers into the digital world?
Yeah, especially the vinyl.
Because
I like my turntable.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
So
it's
good
for transfers, yeah.
So you get some pretty rough records you have to try and clean up a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
How far do you take that process?
Well, you know that physician saying, do no harm?
Uh-huh.
That's kind of what I try to, you know, I go really easy with the digital stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I learned a lot listening to, like, you know, once I started doing it, I would listen to a Hank Williams record or a Bing Crosby record, and you could hear the EQing on the top end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they put a high shelf filter on a lot of stuff, rather than because they didn't have all the tools we got now. And the digital stuff is great for clicks and pops, but you know, if you hit it too hard with the noise reduction, you get those weird artifacts, and it sounds worse than the noise. You know, so. You know, usually I'll go for a high shelf filter before I go for anything else. And I'm sure this is really fascinating to a lot of people.
I think the process is fascinating. I think that we take old music that, especially with the Fervor guys, have been specializing in recent years and finding these old catalogs. of great music all over the country.
Yeah,
and then making it available, but they can't be shipping vinyl records off to the music supervisors.
No, the music supervisors, they can barely work an iPod. So, you know.
Well, they need there's no time. They need a link and an MP3 in 30 seconds and on to the next track, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you have that responsibility of transferring all that stuff to that format.
Yeah, there might be other guys doing it. I don't know.
I think it's cool.
It seems like I'm doing a lot of it, though.
Well, good. And then as far as producing goes, is that something that you think you're going to be spending more time doing with other acts? I mean, is that exciting?
I really like it. I like recording and everything that's involved, you know, with mixing and all that stuff. I really enjoy that probably more than anything right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm kind of getting to the point to where I can just intellectually appreciate the process enough to where I could probably work with something I wasn't that crazy about, which was one hurdle that I never could get over if I didn't like it. I was like, I'm not doing this. I don't know. It just depends on what I'm not actively looking for things, you know, but if they, you know, one of those guys call me up and, hey, we got this band. And, you know,
want you to produce it?
Yeah.
Like, this could be fun.
Then I probably would just do it for kicks, maybe, you know, unless it was god awful. But then again, my standard of god awful is usually something that's going to sell really well. So, it's, you know, it's not a benchmark that anyone should pay attention to.
But I think too, as producing, it is good to be, you know, working on something that you feel like makes sense to you. So you, like you said about these guys, I know where you're trying to go now. Hearing the demo, I know where this needs to go.
It was really, to me, it was very obvious.
It was obvious.
You know, it was. Especially after I heard the demo, you know, I was like, "Oh, I know exactly what you're trying to do."
So why was the record that was brought to you not like the demo in the first place?
I don't know. I mean, I know the people involved, and they're all extremely competent and amazing. I think it
just didn't see the same direction or vision that you saw in the demo.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I don't know. I probably shouldn't really comment on that, but there was just some issues with. I don't know. I don't think it was a good fit. Let me put it that way.
That's what it takes. And speaking of good fits, you've been... I always do horrible segues. So,
that wasn't bad.
Speaking of good fits...
That's a pretty good one.
You fit into a lot of bands in your career here in the Arizona market.
I did.
You were playing in bands long before I came to town, and a lot of really cool ones.
I think Roosevelt was president at the time. I'm not really certain.
Now, you're originally from the area.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in Chicago when I was like 3. You know, when we came out here, so you know, those 3 years in Chicago, I don't know if they count, but so I'm not a true native, but I know who Wallace and Ladmo are, so, you know.
That's pretty much seals the deal. Yeah, I kind of got here after Wallace and Ladmo. And I'm originally from the area as well, from Peoria, Illinois, outside of Chicago, a couple hours, so. I remember the winters. Happy to be here. You may not remember him.
Well, I do, because I went back there and lived there for a couple of years, and I was pretty amazed. I remember standing out in the morning waiting for the L.
Right.
And it was like, I don't know, 20 below or something like that. I don't know. I don't remember. But I just remember, and the sun was out. And I just remember thinking how futile it was. You know, it's like, there you are up there shining with all your power. And like, none of it's hitting here, man.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Barely lighting the road.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, when I go back to the Midwest, I wonder, why are there still people here? But I mean, I get how wonderful the seasons changing can be. But to me, it's like, no, I just can't take the cold.
Right, right. Of course, now I could probably go on a pretty long expose about, you know, bitching about the summer, too, here.
Right.
You know? So, you know, I guess it's 6 of 1, half dozen of another.
Which luckily just ended. And we're into our beautiful winter. But let's get back to your beautiful music career. So was Billy Clone and The Same the first band?
Yeah, that was the first one.
How old were you when you got that band started?
Jesus.
Do you recall?
I don't know, 20, something like that.
How did that happen?
Well, I knew this guy, Mike, from high school, and, you know, we just started playing together. We just wanted to do 60s stuff. You know, we liked 60s music.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we just kind of ended up putting a band together, and then that whole punk thing started.
Right.
And we weren't ever what you would call punk, you know, but we were definitely
punkish.
New wave was
right.
The term, I think, that probably would have been applied to what we were doing. But and it just kind of took off. And I mean, it really was getting a lot of momentum. Mm-hmm. And the singer, Mike, ended up dying, you know, the heroin overdose. And, well, that was that. You know, I mean,
that's one way to end a band.
Yeah. I mean, I was just the guitar player, and I was really happy in that role. Mm-hmm. And I never, ever wanted to be a singer, center guy. I just was never, that was just never a goal of mine. It just seemed like I ended up doing that because then the next thing I did, I couldn't find anybody,
right,
you know, to fit that particular spot.
And you've pretty much been the singer of the acts ever since, haven't you?
Well, yeah, for better or for worse, yeah.
Well, I would say for better. So when, and the next group was the next group the Jetsons, actually?
Yeah, that was the Jetsons. Yeah.
Now, that's the one that people I've read in interviews would be referred to as the most famous band that you were in. Is that because, yes, it was around, yeah, the longest or had the most regional success?
I have no idea what that word even means. I mean,
most memorable for some reason?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big deal here when we were doing it, mm-hmm, you know. But, you know, it was Phoenix. So, mm-hmm, it was like, who cares? And, I mean, I'm not putting Phoenix down, but it's not, you know, it's not.
Well, and certainly then it was a smaller market than it is today.
Yeah, it's not a cultural hub.
Right. Clever name, spelled with a Z.
Well, yeah, that was, I can't remember what the logic was behind that, but yeah, you know, it was, you know, the band did well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. We did pretty well. And it was, again, getting quite a bit of momentum, and the aforementioned type of problems resurfaced, mm-hmm, again. And I like to use passive terms. They surfaced.
They weren't, surfaced.
None of it was my fault.
Not
they
at
just,
all.
They just kind of happened randomly. I don't know what was going, yeah, on there.
Well, but you and, you know, to be honest, I mean, you had a hard time getting through life when you were young. You know, you had problems at home and you ran away a few times. I read in an interview.
Yeah, that's
or
true.
Left home, I say.
Yeah.
You had problems with drugs, with heroin when you were young.
Yeah,
and
I did.
That caused problems with, ended some of the bands you were in. And that's, I mean, you had a tough time getting through your shit for a while.
It ended every band I was in.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, we've all had our own lives and our own paths, but it's kind of, sometimes, you know, it's just, it's tough to find a path that can moves forward well, you know?
You got to go through what you got to go through.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you approach life like, I don't want to get too esoteric.
Oh, get it. Get too esoteric.
You know, I used to approach life like a screenplay, mm-hmm, you know, and that's how I would base on whether it was successful or not, you know, whether it had this nice beginning and a nice,
right,
middle, and then it was all
some drama.
But mine felt like this random bunch of scenes. Garbage that just kept going on and nothing made any sense. And and I know now that's just the nature of it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how it is. And the purpose of it, obviously, in my, I mean, I don't know, I'm not going to talk about the purpose of life, but here I go. for some reason, one has to go through these processes,
right,
you know, and I don't know why. I'm not, I mean, I have maybe some guesses, but it's just part of it. It's just,
yeah,
what you've got to do. You know, being famous or making it or whatever, in my opinion, is not what this is about, you,
right,
know. You know, if you look at guys like, well, even Howard Hughes, I mean, he had everything. You know, he was people bringing him drugs, he had money, no consequences to, and his life was still a waste.
Right.
You know, and I'm not sure why I brought up Howard Hughes. I have no idea how I segued into that. I should borrow some of those segues of yours.
Yeah, that's right.
Segues.
But no, I think you were, you know, in speaking of terms of, you know, getting through life, and you were saying things have to happen. Sometimes that's just the way it is. And I think with artists or really, really strong personalities, they're just going to do things their own way anyway. And it just makes fitting into the way, you know, people tell you life is supposed to be a lot harder.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it's supposed to be in terms of, you know, even on my own supposed rebellious way of looking at things. I don't know if I had ever had a clear idea of how I should conduct myself.
Right.
Yeah. I was mostly just reacting,
mm-hmm,
you know, to things. And I, you know, in some ways, I look back on it, I'm not trying to, you know, lessen my responsibility for what I was, but, you know, I also like a character in a TV show,
mm-hmm,
you know, like, which I think anyone does,
yeah,
you know, it's because you're just so much of, you're dealing with forces beyond your control, and you're coming to grips with that is kind of what you know, at the end of that process, if you're lucky enough to get through it, that's when you find some serenity and some.
Well, interestingly, you said at the beginning of the show that you felt like you were just coming to that place where intellectually maybe you could work on something you didn't want to, just because now you don't just have to do what you want to do. And I think that plays back to the fact that when you were younger, you probably only did what you wanted to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I had the basic emotional maturity of an insect. Yeah. You know, that's basically where I was at.
Well, it's, you know, I know people like that today that are teenagers, and I can tell you that it makes life hard for them. They make life hard on themselves.
It does. God's love them. They're going to go through that.
But I do believe that, you know, that metal is forged in the fire, and sometimes it's that path that creates the incredible expression of an artist. Yeah. Brian Smith is another great example of an incredibly artistic, creative individual that was forged in the fire.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's just kind of the way it goes sometimes. That's the path we have to take.
Yeah, I know Brian. Good guy.
Yeah. Hey, let's play one of your songs.
Sure.
You got a crap load of bands and a bunch of tracks.
Well, those ones I sent you,
mm-hmm.
I just picked one from each one. I don't know.
Let me ask you, this might be a stupid question before I play it, but you said, and I know you're self-deprecating and you're humble, and you mentioned...
No, that's just an accurate appraisal of my work.
You mentioned that you're pretty much ambivalent to anything you've done.
Well,
and what I want to ask you is, if that ambivalence has always been there, what kept you going?
Well, it wasn't always there.
Okay.
It was, you know, I mean...
You were passionate about it.
Well, yeah. When I was younger, I thought everything I did was great.
Okay.
Because it was.
I was
retarded. You know, I know that word's not popular nowadays. I don't really care. But, you know, now I think I can more accurately appraise. And I mean, like the highest I can achieve is, that's okay. You know,
that one doesn't bother me a lot.
That one doesn't. There's nothing really annoying about this particular track. And I don't think I could ever listen to anything I've ever done and go, wow, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Because I can name you 100 tracks right now that are better.
Right.
That are way better. You know, so it's...
Well, when you're in the studio working on, or even in the past working on a track, do you tend to be a first take is the best take and I'm not going to worry about it kind of approach? Or do you like to do it over and over and over and dive in until you think that's the best I can do?
Yeah.
How do you... What's your labor in that process?
I'm pretty autistic.
Okay.
You know, I'm just usually I'm working under time constraints,
right?
So I can't be as... That's why I like mixing.
So it's the old "I've never finished a record; they just keep taking them away from me."
Well, yeah. Well, I'm talking about tracking.
Okay.
You know, tracking. I usually have to. I can't spend anywhere near the amount of time that I want to.
Mm-hmm.
But mixing, I'll spend forever. You know, just gotta get that bass and that kick just right. You know how it is, man.
Yeah.
You know, you just... You know, and you listen to it the next day and you listen to some other song. It's like, no, it's just not there yet.
Well, if you could spend all the time you wanted tracking, what would be the biggest difference in the outcome of the product?
I would try a lot more different stuff.
In terms of instruments or parts?
Yeah, well, with parts and so on and so forth. Probably even before I got to arranging, I would work on rehearsals more and things like that. You know,
mm-hmm.
So, because other than the Noonday Devils, you know, most of the projects I've done in the last however many 10 years has just been pretty rushed.
Right.
And, you know, you've got the guy for a day, you
mm-hmm.
know, whether it's a steel player or a drummer or whatever it is, and you just got to, okay. You know, where you can't just go, you know, don't do this there and try to do this there and let's do this and can you bring that out more?
And then go home and listen to it, you know.
And then change your mind and call him back and go, hey, man, can we do this again? And like, oh, I got this great idea. I read this one part right there.
I remember producing a record with a band and, you know, we're undone, getting close to mixing. We're almost done with overdubs. And one of them says, I think that song needs to be slower. And I'm looking at him going, oh, we're way past cutting jobs. You didn't have a budget where you could go backwards.
Yeah.
We made that decision. And it's wonderful when you have the luxury.
Now you just turned down the rate.
Now, right. Yeah. It's wonderful when you have the luxury in your budget and time constraints to actually just do it until you're done.
Well, you hear about these records in the 70s and the 80s, you know, taking a year.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
I could easily spend a year on a record.
Yeah. And half of that's evaluating.
Yeah.
I was in a mastering session once with Roger Seibel, who mentioned that Michael Jackson spent 30 days mastering a record. Most people spend a couple hours, but he would master it over and over and over before the record, just mastering. And so when you have that luxury, then I think you can really take it to a place.
He was really picky. My good friend Brad worked with him for a long time.
That's right. I read that.
And from everything he told me, he was
insanely busy.
Yeah. Which, but it, you know, it shows.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I said we were going to play a song.
Oh, yeah.
So let's go ahead and do that.
I was trying to postpone that as long as possible.
And listen, I was thinking that maybe we would start with a cut from the Jetsons since we were speaking of them, called Hard Times.
All right.
So this was about 1982.
It was.
And on this track, you are playing guitar and you're singing.
I am.
And is this a, would you consider this a recording you produced, or this was on a record produced by somebody else?
Back in those days, I just went in and played.
You weren't the knob turner.
I didn't know what those knobs did. I didn't want to know. I didn't care. Just, you know, I'd just go in, I'd play my little guitar and sing my little song and go home.
Was this off of Made in America?
No, we did that in Los Angeles, which was after that. So there's actually a stick. Remember those Chapman sticks? There's a stick on there.
Oh, cool. Well, let's check that out. And do you recall the other guys on the track?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Who's on?
Brad Buxer, that I mentioned. This is before he was working with Michael. Lloyd Moffitt.
Okay.
And Craig Romero was playing drums, I believe.
Awesome. Let's check it out. This is Hard Times from the Jetsons with Bruce Canole here on the Otto D Show.
Listening to Otto D, coming at you live.
And that was Hard Times from Bruce Canole and the Jetsons here on the Otto D Show.
Yeah, that didn't sound dated or anything.
Sounded nice. Sounded like a lot of stuff you hear on TV these days.
Yeah, probably a good reason for that.
Well, in fact, that leads us to your relationship with Fervor, who do a lot of television placement of stuff, and that's kind of what a lot of the... These tunes are from their work and the bands they sign in place. How did you meet these guys, and where'd that relationship start?
I think Johnny D was the catalyst there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know
Johnny.
Yeah. They just called me, and we had a meeting, and they offered me some money.
Well, no, that's a rare experience for a musician.
It is a very rare experience.
It's like, I'll take that job.
for a bunch of songs that were just collecting dust, and a bunch of recordings, rather. And so I wisely said yes.
Cool.
And that was it.
And then you recorded a record with them, correct?
I did. I can't remember what it was. Oh, I think it was a bluegrass thing or something.
Okay.
You know, 'cause, I can't remember.
Okay. Now, you worked at Cherokee Studios one time.
Yeah, well, we were doing that was the Jetsons, the Made in America thing. We did a lot of it in L.A.
Was that the first time you went and recorded in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Was that a big deal?
Kind of. You know, I was pretty taken away by Los Angeles at the time. I lived out there for a while, but it's a weird city, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say anything bad about it, but I wouldn't want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Just not my cup of tea. But yeah, whatever. It's a great town. It's a lovely town. Everybody should go there, but I'm not. So
everyone should visit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, I mean, there's things I like, some of the restaurants, I like the beaches, you know, I like to go and I like to come home. I mean, I love living in the desert.
Yeah, I like it out here. I used to hate it, but now I like it, mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, all the things that attracted me about Los Angeles back then, none of those things mean anything to me anymore.
Right.
So,
I mean, the whole club scene that was there then was special.
Yeah, you know? It might have been. I didn't go to any clubs. Okay.
No, but I'm referring to, like, the rooms we all wanted to play.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That only famous people had played, and now every band pays to play, and they're all there. And they
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, somebody. we played all the usual, you know,
yeah.
The lingerie and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know, whatever what happened, clubs were going on at the time.
Cool. Well, let's go on to another band.
Okay.
Let's talk about The Strand.
Oh, The Strand, that was after the Jetsons' demise.
Okay.
And I managed to pull it together for a little while. And it was a three-piece with the bass player from the Jetsons, Damon Doran, and a drummer named Alan Willie. And I couldn't get the keyboard thing out of my head, like I was telling you earlier, so we had MIDI run into the MIDI click track run into the drummer, and then out into the mains we had the whatever key parts. You know,
right.
We had programmed in Cubase. I believe it was Cubase 1.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but it's a long time ago.
It's pretty high tech.
It was then.
Were there even laptops then, or was that in like a tower computer, right? Like
no, I think we were working on an Amiga.
Oh, yeah.
It was an Amiga computer. I can't remember.
I remember those.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. But that was I saw a couple of videos today of that band, and I thought that was a pretty solid, cool little band. Some great stuff.
It was good. I mean, I enjoyed it. I liked the music. It's actually one of the, you know, something from the past I don't mind hearing. You know, but same old story as the other ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oops, sorry about
that's,
that.
That's all right. You can punch my microphone.
I didn't mean to. I must be Italian or something. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. We have that in common.
Yeah.
But I'd read something else that you had said in an interview about when you were very young, you actually discovered country music or had an affinity for some country music, but that you felt you couldn't really bring that to the table with your buds in the band. So
it wasn't so much it was just growing up. You know, I wasn't playing in bands yet or anything, but I mean, I secretly loved country music. I always have. And, you know, when I was a kid, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it was really important to me to be cool. That was the alpha and the omega of my existence. I'm not really sure what the award would be for that. I think, you know, I mean, what's the best you're going to get from that? Like, if you die, maybe somebody might go, oh, yeah, that guy was
cool.
He was pretty cool, that guy.
Whew, got it.
But, I mean, when I think about the amount of time and energy I spent pursuing this... And it was just my particular definition of cool, which
right.
I'm not even sure what the hell it, some kind of weird beatnik thing that I gathered from the zeitgeist, you know, and, you know, it was all consuming. So I couldn't really, you know, be a country music loving aficionado and be cool in that particular time frame. So, you know, I kept a lot of this myself, but like I told you, man, when I was growing up, my favorite song was I Walked the Line. That thing gave me chills when I heard it. It was just so stark and beautiful and haunting. And, you know, like Buck and you know, all that stuff.
Well, The Strand was a bit of a departure from a new wave band.
Yeah. Well, I was pulling my punches there. I really should have just gone all out. You know, when I say it's hard to say country nowadays because nobody knows what you're talking about.
Right.
You know, more the traditional type of 50s, 60s honky tonk country, mm-hmm. you know, or whatever. And that's really what I should have done because that's where I was headed.
Right. Yeah, it seems like you've backed that more and more that way, allowing Americana in and a little bit more bluegrass in and some of this stuff over the years.
Well, it's what I liked. It seemed to be devoid of a lot of pretension, and I don't know. I, it's hard to analyze why you do what you do, but mm-hmm. I liked country. I liked it. You know, we're like. I should explain it. There's a song by the Stanley Brothers called The Drunkard's Hell. And I remember the first time I heard it, it was darker than anything I'd ever heard. It was like, okay, I mean, I love Nick Cave. And this is by no means a cut. I mean, I worship the guy. But Nick Cave was like a horror movie. And this was like driving by a car accident. If you get what I'm saying, It was like, ooh, this is real. And, I think, you know, I've always been drawn to the, you know, that kind of side of things. And it seemed like country and certain aspects of bluegrass, especially bluegrass, because I always thought bluegrass was like, you know Petticoat Junction, you know,
right.
Mom was out and she's making a pie in the kitchen, whatever. It seemed like a joke,
right.
You know? And then when I started really listening to, bluegrass is a misnomer because it's mm-hmm. basically music that, term they use to describe what Bill Monroe came up. The American music behind that stuff, and this stuff is so real and so. I don't know. I don't have the proper adjectives to describe mm-hmm. it, but you know, dark, real, earnest, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of stuff.
And for you as a writer, where does that stuff? Where does that? I've read that you bring your lyrics in kind of last. It seems to be a little less of an important issue for you.
Yeah, lyrics. You know, if you want to know the truth, lyrics are a pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I remember as a kid growing up, I didn't even know half the Beatles. So I don't know what they were saying. I didn't care.
Right.
I just liked the voice. I liked the way it sounded. It was pleasant when I actually did find out the lyrics, you know, like I mentioned Nick Cave, when I do find out what he's saying, it's like,
right.
Oh, wow.
That's clever.
You know, it's rare that somebody can do that. You mm-hmm. know, maybe Dylan in the early 60s and Nick Cave and Leonard Cohen, but most people it's like, you know, write a poem.
Yeah.
Know, that's your best bet there. So I try to just write lyrics that don't get in the way of the music. You know, usually like just certain phrases will come phonetically or whatever. I think Paul Simon, I'm not comparing myself mm-hmm. to him by any stretch of the imagination, but that's how he came up with Mama Don't Take My Kodachrome. Because it's just the combination of, you know, the vowels and the consonants and things that work with the song. So I have like three or four of those, and then I got, oh, okay, and I got to kind of string this together in some way that makes sense.
Right.
That doesn't jar the person from listening to the song.
Right.
Because the songs seem like they come from somewhere else. It doesn't, songwriting never felt like, you know, it wasn't like you were making a pot, you know, or crafting something. It seemed like you were finding something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least in my case. So, you know, you find this thing, you don't want to screw it up. And, you know, one way to do that is to try to get a message out there. You know, I've got this thing I'm going to say, and by God, I'm going to say. Like, no, man. Mm-hmm. You know, let the song, let the melody, let that stuff tell you what's going to happen with the lyrics. I think a lot of good songwriters just do that intuitively. You know, and, you know, like Tom Petty, who I love, you know, every now and then he'll break out of that and it's jarring. You're like, Tom, why did you do that line right there? Mm-hmm. You know, but then other time it just flows
right
immaculately.
Sometimes it rhymes, so I'm done. I can move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, writing is, like you say, looking is a big, there's a big part of discovery involved. And I think that happens in the studio as well. Rather than making a record sound a certain way, you go in there and you kind of allow it to happen. There's a certain amount of allowing and discovering what's going on.
Happy accidents is the,
yeah,
the painting guy used to say. I can't remember his name.
Oh, yeah. On TV.
It's a happy accident.
Cover it up with a cloud.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the Strand was one of my favorites in going back through some of those bands. You know, when you mentioned Johnny D, I should get Johnny D on the show.
Oh, man. You better book a 4 or 5 hour show because yeah, that guy's got more information about.
He probably should have his own show if he doesn't, because there's plenty to talk about.
He's a wealth of Phoenix information. I mean, it's unbelievable how much that guy knows.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were in a bunch of other bands. Let's jump toward the end, the Suicide Kings.
Yeah, that was, I don't know when that was, 96 or 7, something like that.
I loved the story where you got a cease and desist from a band in the West Coast.
Yeah, we did. That's always been the weirdest thing to me. I would get these letters from these guys, and I'd go, you know, online and look at them, and it's usually like some, you know, 50-year-old guys in tight jeans, you know. Yeah, it's like, oh God, you know, what are you gonna? Do you think you're gonna make it? And you know, somehow we're gonna steal your thunder. But you know, they read this book of music, you know, so or this business of music, that book that ruined music for everyone.
Take that, Donald Passman.
I'm sure it's a great book, but when you know, and know. You know, and you got idiots like this reading it, and right. Well, you know, and they, so we had to change the name and. I think I changed it to The Revenants or something.
Right.
And then a couple of years later, they are long gone, you know, and I reformed the Suicide Kings. I said, yeah, just use that name. It's like six bands with that name.
Sure.
Like, who cares? Nobody's going to make it. What the? I mean, who cares? You know?
And when you do, then we'll let you have it.
Yeah. Then when you do, we'll get lawyers and everybody. It'll all work out. Believe me, it'll work out.
That's the way it goes. Well, speaking of work it out, this is another great segue. How about co-writing? Do you find that difficult, or is that something you've ever enjoyed?
I've never done it.
Okay.
Not once. I just don't know how I don't know how that works. I just don't know.
Okay. Well, maybe, you know, it's because you've never done it.
Yeah.
No, sit in a room with another guy with a guitar and don't say anything. Just play and just see what happens.
Sounds like fun.
It might not start out that way. But I think it's kind of like producing. Nothing matters until there's something that's good and they screw it up. You're like, oh no, this is what should happen there. Mm. And all of a sudden that's when you have 2 cents, you know? And, but I've always found it's difficult to co-write unless the jobs are kind of, the responsibilities are kind of laid out, like you do the words and I'll do them.
Right.
But even then, it can get kind of weird.
Oh, God, I'd love to have a lyricist.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Oh, that'd be great, because I'd never have to write another damn lyric.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the way Paul Simon was writing. I had read that Sting did some similar things where he would make the melody and use vowel sounds and nonsense words, but he would pick that's going to be this vowel on that note,
yeah.
You know, because it just sounds musical, you know.
So that's probably how we came up with da-do-do-do-do, whatever the hell that thing is.
All of those. So now, as you're playing out now, what format or what's the band, or do you solo show?
Well, I don't play out very much. Usually if I do, it's the Suicide Kinks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this version of it. Mm-hmm. Great bunch of players. I do like maybe two, three gigs a year. I'm not really.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about Busted Hearts.
Busted Hearts was I learned how to play the banjo. And, you know, you gotta do something with that. So I put together a little bluegrass band. You know, I just wanted to make the music that I was hearing, that I loved, mm-hmm. you know, because I went through this period, but that's all I listened to. You know, the Stanley Brothers and, you know, all those good old bands. And so, you know, I just threw together this little bluegrass outfit, and we played at Long Wong's. I think we had a weekly Sunday night gig at Long Wong's.
Okay. Well, and you mentioned... going through periods stylistically,
uh-huh.
I think that's represented in your the work you released as well. But do you listen to a lot of music now? A lot of new music.
I listen to music. If I'm awake, I'm listening to music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where do you listen?
Spotify. I'm on my computer 24 hours a day, so you know that's right there, and it's all running into the, you know, the vocals and everything, so it sounds great. I think Spotify. You know, I'm not getting paid by them or anything, but I've been able to find so much new music that I like. And, you know, like I was telling you earlier, I have very specific, odd tastes. You know, I love psychedelic stuff. I mm-hmm. just love it. And it's never ceases to amaze me how many people are out there doing that. You know, I also like electronic music. And you know, it's really hard to, you know, like, let's say you want to get into dubstep or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a dated term now, but you know, how the hell would you go about that before? If you weren't a kid out in the scene, out hanging out, you know, you're just some old guy in your apartment with your computer, you know, how the hell would you come up with something, you know, what's good to hear and what's not good to hear? It's Spotify, you know, and their algorithms are pretty good. You know, so I keep finding these gents, the OCs, I think it's Deer Hunter or Deer Slayer, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Moon Duo, you know, all those Brian Jonestown spinoffs. You know, there's just so much good stuff out there. It's amazing to me.
I spend no time on Spotify.
Really?
Yeah, I should probably do that.
Well, I mean,
I don't, actually don't listen to music much.
I did, well, before I got into the whole computer listening online thing, I would just crank up the same old, well, let's listen to Rock the Music Avalon again.
Great record.
It's an amazing record, but, you know, after about 8 bazillion play, because I couldn't find anything, you know, there's no way whatever's on the top 10 and top 100 is just going to be garbage. Well, you know, whatever.
It's, for you,
it's not going to be my cup of tea. Yeah. Let me be, yeah, you know, diplomatic here. So, you know, to have a venue where I could find stuff. Because we, I mean, in the old days, we had gatekeepers. You know, mm-hmm, radio stations were gatekeepers. You know, like, here's the 40 songs you're going to listen to this week. And, you know, they even played with time. Like, I remember, like, the oldie stations would only play, like, the same 20 songs from the 60s. Like, well, I was alive then, and I remember there was a lot more than those 20, you know. You know, there was a lot more going on than Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And, you know, this opens up this whole... You know, without this, I don't want to just single out Spotify. I'm sure there's other algorithms out there that are just as good. But I was, you know, as I always test a music service with, I'll pick a Nick Cave song and see what they suggest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've done this with some other applications in the past. I won't mention their names. And they were just way off the mark.
Right.
You know, like, if you like Nick Cave, you might like Gordon Lightfoot. And I was like, well, I do like Gordon Lightfoot, but that's not what I'm looking for here, you know? So, but Spotify just seemed to nail it.
Uh-huh.
You know? And then it would pull in a lot of stuff that I'd never, and even YouTube. I mean, I'm just amazed at the amount of music that's out there that nobody knows about.
It's ridiculous how much stuff is out there.
I was looking for some reference tracks for some stuff, and it was Psychobilly. I was looking for Psychobilly, which is, you know, a more aggressive form of rockabilly. And I went on YouTube, Psychobilly playlist, boom, okay? There's like 200 bands, you know? It's like, okay, they're all going to suck, right? Not about half of them were pretty good. It's like, I have never heard of any of these guys, not one of them. And a lot of this stuff is stuff I like.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's great.
Now, you're a computer guy, too. I mean, a techie guy. So you're probably more impressed with the algorithm, the concept of a good algorithm than another.
Well, whatever they're doing behind the scenes, you know, the database stuff and all the AI or whatever they got going on there, it's pretty impressive because they're pretty much on the money. You know, it gets a little repetitive, and sometimes you have to throw out a curveball so it'll pull up some newer stuff. But, you know, to be able to find 2 or 3 songs a week that you love... that are new.
That's pretty awesome.
That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. I mean, it hasn't happened in like 25 years for me.
Yeah, on the radio.
Yeah, on the radio.
Yeah, I think I turned the radio off like in the early 90s.
Sometimes when I'm in my car, I'll pop on the FM thing and just start bumping around to it, mm-hmm, just to hear what, you know, to hear what the plebeians are listening to. But I don't know, man. It's not very encouraging.
Well, it's cool that the stuff is out there and kind of like the gatekeepers are gone.
Yeah.
Right, at least from that format.
Yeah, the only drawback, well, no, there is no drawback. I was going to say the only drawback is you really have to kind of be industrious to find things, but that's always been the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but at least now you have the tools to look with.
Now, when you mentioned living in California for a little while.
Yeah.
And did that coincide with your tech work? Because you did some work.
No. No, no, that was San Francisco. That was in 2000. No, when I was living in L.A., I was just a roustabout, a general roustabout.
But what's this big background in Silicon Valley then? What were
nothing.
Your,
I just...
oh, come on. Just cough it up, Bruce.
Okay. Well, I'm handy with computers. You know, okay. I kind of know why, you know, I know how to do, what to do if something crashes, right?
Right.
which puts you in the upper percentile of anyone who's ever worked on a computer, yeah, evidently. And there was a Mary McCann.
Yeah.
She was working for this outfit called Sonic Box, and they were in Mountain View, and she was having all these problems with her computer, you know, and she was calling me all the time, and then finally they said, hey, why don't you just come out here? And
be our IT guy, huh?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't their IT guy. I was just their fixer, troubleshooter, okay, or whatever. So, oh, that's what I did, because they were looking for radio stations. You know, the idea was they had this box that you could stream an online radio station to your stereo, you know, which in 2000 was like
big deal.
Big deal. And so I would have to go in and deep link all the, so they could sample the channels, because a lot of them were hiding their links and so on, so you couldn't hear the station. So my job was, on a lot of it, was to go in and deep link and get the stuff, you know, and you'd be pulling it out of flash modules and all this other, mm-hmm, kind of stuff, you know, just, you know, just looking for the HTTP.
Right.
You know.
So have you always been a computer guy?
No, I got one in, well, kind of. I mean, we had a, me and Brad had Commodore 64s back in the Jetsons. We loved those things. And then I got out of it for a long time. And then in 95, I bought a, or 90, whenever the Suicide Kings was, so I guess it was, mm-hmm, 97, I bought a computer to make a web page. I was going to make a web page for the band. And then I remember the first 3 days I had it, I didn't sleep. I was like, man, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, the computer plus the internet. Like, I'm on to something here.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, I'll never ask for help. So you have to figure everything out yourself. You know,
right.
And the computer, you can. Cause,
yeah, these days.
You know, you got a question? Yeah, you know, search. So, you know.
I had a 10 or 12-year-old kid show me how to blur a logo out of a moving car in a video. The first two kids couldn't explain themselves. The third kid, I understood it, but it made it work. You know, it's amazing what's out there.
Yeah, they're great.
All the answers.
I love them.
Listen, we've got enough time to play another song.
Okay.
And I was thinking How I Cried is a Strand tune.
Sure, whatever you want to play.
From back in the day. Let's spin that one. So you remember this cut?
I do remember this cut.
And you want to tell me what it's about?
Oh, it's just about being a drunk loser.
Okay. That's how you cried?
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
The lyrics didn't matter anyway.
Well, the "my" always bothered me because it sounded like some kind of southern damsel, like, "my, how I cry," you know. But, you know, I needed another word there, so.
Yeah, musically. Cool. Well, let's check it out. This is The Strand from, I think, about 1987.
Yeah.
With Bruce Canole.
Yeah, that's about right.
Here on the Otto D Show with How I Cried. Check it out.
Hey!
You're listening to Parody, coming at you live.
And that was Bruce Canole here on the Auto D Show with How I Cried back in the days when he was playing with the Strand. Pretty cool little project. Great song.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was fun.
How many songs would you say that you've actually recorded and released? Just a rough estimate.
I don't know.
50, 60, 70?
Yeah, maybe 40 or 50, somewhere like that. Maybe less.
Or five, six records.
I don't know. I have no idea.
And you mentioned in an interview that you have lots of bits and pieces that you write that sit around waiting for the...
Yeah,
the right time to finish, or the right words, or the right reason.
They're really waiting now. I always, if I get a good idea, I just, beat it out on the guitar and track it,
mm-hmm.
and just save it. And so I've got tons of stuff.
And what's your, preferred piece of gear these days? Do you record on your phone ideas? Do you call voicemail and leave messages when you just have an idea, or do you go to a tape machine and hit record?
Everything's
so you're just ready to go. So grab your guitar, turn on
nice
Pro Tools,
condenser mic, or I pull it over. And
so even your ideas are stored like they're a track on a master, ready to go in case you use them.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got the gear. Why not? I'll run through the UA preamp into the API, into the just play, and then it always sounds better.
Yeah,
sounds nice.
That's pretty cool.
Those UA tubes.
Yeah.
Getting warm it up a little bit.
Nice stuff. Well, listen, man, we're already on the end of the hour. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Well, keeps flying by.
I enjoyed myself, surprisingly enough.
Well, thanks for coming in. It's been fun to chat with you and play some of this stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Good luck in your future projects, and I'll look for some of those tracks of yours through Fervor on TV.
Yes, sir. Yeah, well, go right ahead.
Good luck. Talk to you soon.
Okay.